And so, you see, a marriage made for the good of the kingdom can come to be happy.
I loved Uther.
I could wish just such good fortune for you, that you and my son may come to love one another that way.
I hope that too.
Guinevere clutched again at Igraine's hand. To Igraine, the fingers felt small and soft, easily crushed, unlike her own strong, competent ones. This wasn't a hand for tending babes or wounded men, but for fine needlework or prayer. Leodegrance should have left this child in her convent, and Arthur sought elsewhere for a bride. Things would go as God had ordained. She was sorry for Guinevere's fright, but she was also sorry for Arthur with a bride so childish and unwilling. Yet she herself had been no better when she was sent to Gaulois. Perhaps the girl's strength would grow with the years. With the first rays of the sun, the camp was astir, making ready for the day's march that would bring them to Caerleon. Guinevere looked white and weak, and when she tried to get up, she turned on her side and retched. For a moment, Igraine entertained an uncharitable suspicion, then put it aside. The girl, cloistered and timid, was ill with fright, no more. She said briskly, "I told you the closed litter would make you queasy. Today you must get on your horse and take the fresh air, or we shall have you coming to your bridal with pale cheeks instead of roses." She added to herself, "And if I must ride behind closed curtains for another day, I shall certainly go mad." That would be a wedding to remember indeed, with a bride sick and pale, and the mother of the bridegroom raving. "Come, if you will get up and ride, Lancelot shall ride with you, to gossip with you and cheer you." Guinevere braided her hair, and even gave some thought to the arranging of her veil. She ate little, but she did sip a little barley beer, and put a bit of bread in her pocket, saying that she would eat it later as she rode. Lancelot had been out and about since first light. When Igraine suggested, "You must ride with my lady, she is moping. She's never been from home before," his eyes lighted up and he smiled. "It will be my pleasure, madam." Igraine rode alone behind the young people, glad of the solitude for her own thoughts. How handsome they were! Lancelot so dark and spirited, and Guinevere all golden and white. Arthur was fair too. Their children would be dazzling. She realized with some surprise that she was looking forward to being a grandmother. It would be pleasant to have little children about, to pet them and play with them, but children who weren't her own, over whom she needn't worry and fret and trouble herself. She rode in a pleasant daydream. She'd grown used to daydreaming a good deal in the convent. Looking ahead to the young people riding side by side, she saw that the girl sat her horse upright and had some colour in her face and was smiling. Igraine had done right to get her out into the air. And then she saw how they were looking at each other. "Dear God, Uther looked so at me when I was Gaulois's wife, as if he were starving and I were food high out of his reach. What can possibly come of it if they love one another? Lancelot is honourable, and Guinevere, I would swear, virtuous. So what can possibly come of it except misery?" Then she reproved herself for her suspicions. They were riding at a decent distance from one another. They didn't seek to touch hands. They were smiling because they were young and it was a fair day. Guinevere rode to her wedding, and Lancelot brought horses and men to his king, his cousin, and friend. Why shouldn't they be happy and talk with one another gaily and joyously? I'm an evil-minded old woman. But she still felt troubled. What will come of this? Dear God, would it be traitorous to you to pray for a moment of the sight? And then she wondered, was there yet any honourable way for Arthur to get out of this marriage? For the High King to wed a woman whose heart was already given, that would be a tragedy. Britain was filled with maidens ready to love him and wed him. But the dowry price was paid. The bride had left her father's house. The subject kings and liegemen were assembling to see their young king married. Igraine resolved to speak to the Merlin. As Arthur's chiefest counsellor, perhaps he could yet prevent this marriage. But could even he prevent it without war and ruin? It would be a pity, too, for Guinevere to be publicly rejected like this in the presence of all Britain. No, it was too late. The wedding must take place as it was fated. Igraine sighed and rode on, her head lowered, and all the beauty gone from the bright day. She told herself angry that all her doubts and fears were meaningless, an idle old woman's imaginings, or that all of these fantasies were sent of the devil to tempt her into using the sight she had renounced and becoming again a tool of wickedness and sorcery. Yet as she rode, her eyes kept returning to Guinevere and Lancelot, and to the almost visible haze that seemed to hover between them, an aura of hunger and desire and longing. They arrived at Caerleon shortly before sunset. The castle stood on a hill, the site of an old Roman fort, and some of the old Roman stonework was still in place. It looked, Igraine thought, very much as it must have looked in Roman days. For a moment, seeing the slopes covered with tents and people, she wondered dizzily if the place were under siege. But then she realized that all these folk must have come to see the High King married. Seeing the crowd, Guinevere had turned pale and terrified again. Lancelot was trying to arrange the long, draggled column into some vestige of dignity. And Guinevere put her veil down over her face and rode silent by Igraine. "It's a pity they must all see you worn and travel-weary," Igraine agreed. "But look, there is Arthur come out to meet us." The girl was so weary she hardly raised her head. Arthur, in a long blue tunic, his sword in its preciously worked crimson scabbard swinging at his side, had stopped to speak for a moment to Lancelot at the head of the column. Then, the crowding men and riders separating as he walked through them, he came toward Igraine and Guinevere. He bowed to his mother. "Had you a good journey, madam?" But he had raised his eyes to Guinevere, and Igraine saw his eyes widen at her beauty, and could almost read the younger girl's thoughts. "Yes, I am beautiful. Lancelot thinks me beautiful. Will my Lord Arthur be pleased with me?" Arthur held out his hand to support her as she dismounted. She tottered a little, and he stretched out both arms to her. "My lady and wife, welcome to your home and to my house. May you be happy here, and may this day be as joyous for you as for me." Guinevere felt the crimson rising in her cheeks. "Yes, Arthur was handsome," she told herself fiercely, with that fair hair and the serious level grey eyes. How different he seemed from Lancelot's madcap gaiety and mischief. And how differently he looked at her. Lancelot looked at her as if she were the statue of the Virgin on the altar at church. But Arthur was looking at her soberly, tentatively, as if she were a stranger, and he wasn't yet sure whether friend or foe. She said, "I thank you, my husband and my lord. As you can see, I have brought you the promised dowry of men and horses."
"How many horses?" he asked quickly. Guinevere was confused. What did she know about his precious horses?
Did he have to make it so clear that it was the horses and not herself which he awaited in this wedding business?
She drew herself to her full height. She was taller than some men, and for a woman she was a good height, and said with dignity,
"I do not know, my Lord Arthur.
I haven't counted them.
You must ask your captain of horse. I'm sure the Lord Lancelot could tell you their number to the last mare and the last foal at Suck.
Oh, good girl,
Igraine thought, seeing the colour rise in Arthur's pale cheeks at the reproof. He smiled ruefully.
Forgive me, my lady. No one expects of you that you should concern yourself with such things. I'm sure Lancelot will tell me all of this at the proper time. I was thinking also of the men who came with you. It seems fit that I should welcome them as my new subjects, as well as welcoming their lady and my queen. For a moment he looked almost as young as he was. He looked around at the milling crowd of men, horses, carts, oxen, and drovers, and spread his hands helplessly. In all this hullabaloo, I doubt they could hear me anyway. Allow me to conduct you to the castle gates. He took her hand and led her along the path, searching for the driest places. I'm afraid this is a dismal old place. It was my father's stronghold. But I never lived here after I was old enough to remember. Perhaps some year, if the Saxons let us alone for a time, we can find some place better suited for our home. But for the moment, this must suit. As he led her through the gates, Guinevere reached out and touched the wall. It was thick, secure Roman stone, piled high and standing as if it had been there since the beginning of the world. Here all was safe. She ran her finger almost lovingly along the wall. I think it's beautiful. I'm sure it will be safe. I mean, I'm sure I will be happy here. I hope so, Lady Guinevere, he said, using her name for the first time, speaking it with a strange accent.
She wondered suddenly where he had been reared. I'm very young to be in charge of all these men and kingdoms.
I'll be glad to have a helpmeet.
She heard his voice tremble as if he were afraid. But what in the world could a man have to be afraid of?
My uncle by marriage, Lot, King of Orkney. He's married to my mother's sister, Morgause. And Lot has said that his wife rules as well as he, when he is absent in war or council. I'm willing to do you such honour, lady, and let you rule at my side.
Panic clutched again at Guinevere's stomach. How could he expect that of her? How could it be a woman's place to rule? What did she care what the wild barbarians, these northern tribesmen, did, or their barbarian women? She said, in a shaky little voice, I could never presume so far, my lord and my king.
Igraine said firmly, Arthur, my son, what are you thinking of? The girl has been riding for 2 days, and she is exhausted. This is no time to plot the strategy of kingdoms, with the mud of the road still on our shoes. I beg you, turn us over to your chamberlains, and there will be time enough to acquaint yourself with your bride tomorrow.
Arthur's skin, Guinevere thought, was fairer than her own. This was the second time she had seen him blush like a scolded child.
I'm sorry, mother. And you, my lady.
He raised his arm, signalling, and a dark, slender young man with a scarred face and a pronounced limp came unevenly toward them.
My foster brother, Kai, and my chamberlain, Arthur said. Kai, this is Guinevere, my lady and queen.
Kai bowed to her with a smile.
I'm at your service.
As you can see, Arthur said, my lady has brought her furniture and belongings. Lady, I welcome you to your own house.
Give Kai whatever orders seem good to you about where to bestow your things. For now, I beg you, give me leave to go. I must see to the men and horses and gear.
He bowed low again, and it seemed to Guinevere that she could see relief on his face. She wondered if he was disappointed in her, or whether his only interest in this marriage was really in the dowry of horses and men, as she had thought. Well, She had been prepared for that, but still, some welcome for her personally would have been pleasant. She realized that the dark, scarred young man he called Kai was waiting expectantly for her word. He was gentle and deferential. She needn't be afraid of him. She sighed, reaching out again to touch the strong walls around her, as if for reassurance, and to steady her voice, so that when she spoke, she would sound like a queen. "In the greatest of carts, Sir Kai, there is an Irish mead hall table. It is my father's wedding gift to my Lord Arthur. It is a prize of war, and very old, and very valuable. See to it that it is assembled in Arthur's largest feasting hall. But before that, please see to it that a room is made ready for my Lady Igraine, and someone to wait on her tonight." Distantly she was surprised. She thought to herself that she sounded quite like a queen. Nor did Kai sound at all reluctant to accept her as one. He bowed very low and said, "It shall be done at once, my lady and queen." Chapter 5. All through the night, groups of travellers had been assembling before the castle. It was barely daylight when Guinevere looked out to see the whole slope of the hill leading up to the castle, covered with horses and tents, and with crowds of men and women. "It looks like a festival," she said to Igraine, who had shared her bed on this last night of her maidenhood, and the older woman smiled. "When the High King takes a wife, child, that is as much a festival as anything happening in this island. Look, those men are the followers of Lot of Orkney." She thought, but didn't say aloud, "Perhaps Morgaine will be with them." As a young woman, she had voiced every thought that crossed her mind, but no longer. How strange it was, Igraine thought. All through the childbearing years, a woman is taught to think first and only of her sons. If she thinks of her daughters at all, it is only that when they are grown, they will go forth into the hands of another. They are being reared for another family. Was it only that Morgaine had been her firstborn, always closest to her heart? Arthur had returned physically after his long absence, but as all men do, he had grown so far from her that there was no longer any way to reach across that distance. But to Morgaine, she had discovered this at Arthur's crowning, she was bound with a tie of the soul which would never break. Was it only that Morgaine had shared her own heritage of Avalon? Was this why every priestess longed to bear a daughter who would follow in her footsteps and never be lost to her? "There are so many people," Guinevere said. "I didn't know there were so many people in all of Britain."
"And you to be High Queen and over them all. It is frightening, I know," said Igraine. "I felt so when I was married to Uther."
And for a moment it seemed to her that Arthur had chosen ill in his queen. Guinevere had beauty, yes, and good temper, and learning. But a queen must be able to take her place at the forefront of the court. Perhaps Guinevere was all too shy and retiring. When you put it into the simplest terms, the queen was the king's lady, not only his hostess and keeper of his house. Any chamberlain or housekeeper could do that, but, like the priestess of Avalon, a symbol of all the realities of life, a reminder that life was more than fighting and war and dominion. A king, when all was said and done, fought for the protection of those who were unable to fight for themselves, the child-bearing women and little children and old people, aged men and grandmothers. Among the tribes, indeed, the stronger women had fought at the side of the men. There had been, of old, a battle college kept by women. But from the beginning of civilization it had been the work of men to hunt for food and to keep off invaders from the hearth-fire, where their pregnant women and little children and old folk were sheltered, and the work of women to keep that hearth safe for them. As the king was joined to the high priestess in the symbolic marriage to the land in token that he would bring strength to his kingdom, so the queen, in a similar joining to the king, created a symbol of the central strength behind all the armies and the wars, the home and the centre for which men rallied their strength. Igraine shook her head impatiently. All this of symbols and inner truths was fit, perhaps, for a priestess of Avalon. But she, Igraine, had been queen enough without any such thoughts. And there would be time enough for Guinevere to think of these things when she was an old woman and no longer needed them. In these civilized days, a queen was not a priestess over villagers tending their barley fields any more than a king was the great hunter who ranged among the deer. Come, Guinevere. Kai left serving women to wait on you. But as your husband's mother, it is suitable that I should dress you for your wedding, since your own mother cannot be here to make you ready on this day. The younger woman looked like an angel when she was clothed. Her fine hair floated like spun gold in the sunlight, almost dimming the radiance of the golden garland she had put on. Her dress was of a white woven stuff, as fine as spiderweb. Guinevere told Igraine with shy pride that the fabric had been brought from a far country, further even than Rome, and was more costly than gold. Her father had gotten a length for the altar stone of their church, and a little piece to hold a holy relic, and he had given her a piece too, of which she had made her wedding gown. There was more for a holiday tunic for Arthur. It was her own wedding gift to him. Lancelot came to conduct them to the early mass which would precede the wedding. Afterward, all the day could be given to feasting and revelry. He was resplendent in the crimson cloak he had worn before, but he was dressed for riding. "Do you go from us, Lancelot?" "No," he said soberly, but he was looking only at Guinevere. "As one of the entertainments of this day, the new horsemen and Arthur's cavalry will display what they can do. I'm one of the horsemen who will show you these games this afternoon. Arthur feels it is time to make his plans known to his people." And again Igraine saw that hopeless, transfixed look in his eyes when he looked on Guinevere, and the brilliance of the girl's smile as she looked up to him. She couldn't hear now what they were saying to each other. She had no doubt it was innocent enough. But they needed no words. Igraine felt again the despairing awareness that this would come to no good, but only to misery. They walked down through the corridors, joined as they went by serving people, noblemen, all those clustering to the early mass. On the steps of the chapel they were joined by two young men who wore, like Lancelot himself, long black feathers in their caps. Kai, she recalled, had worn one too. Was it some badge of Arthur's companions? Lancelot asked, "Where is Kai, brother? Should he not be here to escort my lady to the church?" One of the newcomers, a big sturdy man who, Guinevere thought, had nevertheless a look of Lancelot, said, "Kai and Gawain, too, are dressing Arthur for his wedding. Indeed, I thought you would be among them. You three are like brothers to Arthur. He sent me to take their place as the Lady Igraine's kinswoman." "Madam," he said to Igraine, bowing, "can it be that you don't recognize me? I'm the son of the Lady of the Lake. My name is Balin, and this is our foster brother, Balin." Guinevere nodded courteously to them. She thought, can this big, coarse Balin truly be Lancelot's brother? It is as if a bull should call himself brother to the finest of southern stallions. Balin, his foster brother, was short and red-faced, with hair as yellow as a Saxon's, and bearded like a Saxon, too. She said, "Lancelot, if it is your will to be with my lord and king..."
"I think you ought to go to him, Lancelot," said Balin with a laugh. "Like all men about to wed, Arthur is mad with nervousness. Our lord may fight like Pendragon himself on the field of battle. But this morning, when he's being readied for his bride, he seems no more than the boy he is.
Poor Arthur, thought Guinevere. This marriage is more of an ordeal for him than for me. At least I have nothing to do but obey the will of my father and king.
A ripple of amusement went over her, quickly stifled.
Poor Arthur! He would have had to take her for the good of his kingdom, even if she really had been old or ugly or pockmarked. It was just another of his painful duties, like leading his men into battle against the Saxons.
At least he knew what he could expect of the Saxons.
She said gently, "My Lord Lancelot, would you rather be at my Lord Arthur's side?" His eyes told her clearly that he didn't want to leave her. She had become, in only a day or two, adept at reading those messages unspoken. She had never exchanged with Lancelot one word that couldn't have been shouted aloud in the presence of Igraine and her father and all the bishops of Britain assembled. But for the first time, he seemed torn by conflicting desires.
"The last thing I wish is to leave your side, madam. But Arthur is my friend and my cousin."
"God forbid that I should ever come between you kinsmen," she said, and held out her small hand to him to kiss. "By this marriage you are my loyal kinsman too, and my cousin. Go to my lord the king and tell him..."
She hesitated, startled at her own boldness. Would it be seemly to say this? God help them all! Within the hour she would be Arthur's wife. What did it matter if it sounded overbold when what she spoke were words of proper concern for her own lord?
"Tell him I gladly return to him his most loyal captain, and that I await him with love and obedience, sir."
Lancelot smiled. It seemed that smile stretched a string somewhere deep inside her, that she felt her own mouth moving with it.
How could she feel so much a part of him?
Her whole life seemed to have filtered down into the touch of his lips on her fingers. She swallowed, and suddenly she knew what it was she felt. In spite of her dutiful messages of love and obedience to Arthur, it seemed that she would sell her soul if time would only turn back and she could tell her father that she would marry no man but Lancelot. That was something as real as the sun around her and the grass under her feet, as real, she swallowed again, as real as Arthur now being readied for the wedding for which she must go to Holy Mass to prepare herself.
"Is it one of God's cruel jokes that I didn't know this was what I felt until it was too late? Or is this some wicked trick of the fiend to seduce me from my duty to my father and to my husband?"
She didn't hear what Lancelot said. She was only conscious that his hand had released hers, and that he had turned his back and was walking away. She hardly heard the polite words of those two foster brothers, Balin and Balan.
Which of them was the son of the priestess of the lake, then?
Balan, Lancelot's brother. But no more like him than a raven is like a great eagle. She became aware that Igraine was speaking to her.
"I leave you to the companions, my dear. I wish to speak with the Merlin before the Mass."
Belatedly it occurred to Guinevere that Igraine was awaiting her permission to go. Already her rank as High Queen was a reality. She hardly heard her own words to Igraine as the older woman withdrew. Igraine crossed the courtyard, murmuring excuses to the people she jostled, trying to reach Taliesin through the crowd. Everyone was clad in bright festival clothing, but he wore his usual sombre grey robes.
"Father?"
"Igraine, child."
Taliesin looked down at her, and Igraine found it obscurely comforting that the old druid spoke to her as he would have spoken to her when she was 14.
I had thought you would be in attendance upon our bride. How beautiful she is! Arthur has found himself a treasure. I have heard that she is clever, too, and learned, and also that she is pious, which will please the bishop.
Father, Igraine appealed, lowering her voice so that no one in the crowd would hear. I must ask you this. Is there any honourable way for Arthur to avoid this marriage? Taliesin blinked in consternation.
No, I don't think so. Not when all is ready to join them together after the Mass. God help us, have we all been deceived? Is she barren, or unchaste, or...
The Merlin shook his head in dismay.
Unless she were secretly a leper, or actually with child by another man, there could be no way at all to stop it. And even then, no way without scandal or offence, or making an enemy of Leodegrance. Why do you ask, Igraine?
I believe her virtuous, but I have seen the way she looks at Lancelot and he at her. Can anything come of it but misery when the bride is besotted with another, and that other the groom's dearest friend? The Merlin looked at her sharply. His old eyes were as seeing as ever.
Oh, it is like that, is it? I've always thought our Lancelot had too much good looks and charm for his own welfare. Yet he's an honourable lad, after all. It may be nothing but youthful fancies. And when the bridal pair are wedded and bedded, they will forget it, or think of it only with a little sadness, as something that might have been.
In 9 cases out of 10, I would say you were right, Igraine said. But you have not seen them, and I have. The Merlin sighed again.
Igraine, I don't say you are wrong, but when all's done, what can we do about it? Leodegrance would find it such an insult that he would go to war against Arthur, and Arthur has already enough to challenge his kingship. Or have you not heard of yonder northern king who sent word to Arthur that he had skinned the beards of 11 kings to make himself a cloak, and Arthur should send him tribute, or he would come and take Arthur's beard too?
What did Arthur do?
The Merlin said, Why, he sent the older king word that as for his beard it was scarce grown yet, and it would do him no good for his cloak, but that if he wanted it, he could come and try to take it if he could find his way through the bodies of dead Saxons. And he sent him the head of one of the Saxons. He'd just come back from a raiding party, and said, Its beard was better for lining a cloak than the beard of a friend at whose side he would rather be fighting. And finally he said he would send a fellow king a present, but he exacted no tribute from his friends, and paid none. So that all came to nothing. But as you can see, Arthur cannot afford more enemies, and Leodegrance would be a bad one. He'd better marry the girl. And I think I would say the same even if he'd found her in bed with Lancelot, which he hasn't, and isn't likely to.
Igraine discovered that she was twisting her hands together. What shall we do? The Merlin touched her cheek very lightly.
We will do what we have always done, Igraine. What we must. What the gods order. We will do the best we can. We are none of us embarked on this course for our own happiness, my child. You, who were reared in Avalon, you know that. Whatever we may do to try and shape our destiny, the end is with the gods, or, as the bishop would no doubt prefer me to say, with God. The older I grow, the more I become certain that it makes no difference what words we use to tell the same truths. "The lady wouldn't be pleased to hear you speak such words,"
said a dark, thin-faced man behind him, in dark robes which could have been those of a priest or a druid. Taliesin turned half round and smiled.
"Nevertheless, Vivian knows they are true, as I do. Igraine, I don't think you know our newest of chief bards. I brought him hither to sing and play for Arthur's wedding. Kevin, madam.
Kevin bowed low. Igraine noticed that he walked leaning on a carven stick. His harp, in its case, was carried by a boy of 12 or 13. Many bards or harpers who weren't druids were blind or lamed. It was rare that any able-bodied lad would be given time and leisure to learn such arts in these days of war, but usually the druids chose among those who were sound of body as well as being keen of mind. It was rare for a man with any deformity to be allowed into the druid teachings. It was felt that the gods marked inner faults in this way. But it would have been inexcusably rude to speak of this. She could only imagine that his gifts were so great that he had been accepted in despite of all else. He had diverted her mind from her purpose, but when she thought back, Taliesin was right. There was no way to stop this wedding without scandal and probably war. Inside the Wattle and Daub building that was the church, lights blazed and the bell had begun to ring. Igraine walked into the church. Taliesin knelt stiffly down, so did the boy carrying Kevin's harp. But Kevin himself didn't kneel. For a moment Igraine wondered if, not being a Christian, he was defying the services, as Uther had once seemed to do. Then she decided, seeing the awkwardness of his gait, that he probably had a stiff leg and couldn't bend the knee at all. She saw the bishop look his way, frowning. "Listen to the words of Jesus Christ our Lord," the bishop began. "Behold, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I among ye, and whatsoever thing ye ask in my name, so it shall be done." Igraine knelt, drawing her veil around her face, but she was conscious, nevertheless, of Arthur, who had come into the church with Kai and Lancelot and Gawain, wearing a fine white tunic and a blue cloak, with no ornament but the slender gold coronet of his crowning, and the crimson and jewels in the scabbard of his great sword. It seemed as if without eyes she could see Guinevere in her fragile white gown, like Arthur, all white and gold, kneeling between Balin and Balan. Lot, greying and thin, knelt between Morgause and one of his younger sons, and behind him it was as if a harp had sounded some high forbidden note through the chanting of the priest. She raised her head cautiously and tried to see, knowing who knelt there. The face and form of Morgaine were hidden behind Morgause. Yet it seemed that she could sense her there, like a wrong note in the harmony of the sacred service. After all these years, was she reading thoughts again? In any case, what was a priestess of Avalon doing in the church? When Vivien had visited her and Uther in the years of their marriage, the priestess had either absented herself from divine service, or attended, listening and watching with the polite, grave attention she would have given to a child playing at a feast for her dolls. Yet now she could see Morgaine, she had changed. She was thinner, more beautiful, simply clad in a dress of fine dark wool, with a proper white coif around her head. She wasn't doing anything. She knelt with her head bent and her eyes lowered, the picture of respectful attention. Yet even the priest, it seemed, could sense the disruption and impatience emanating from her. He stopped twice and looked at her, although there was no way he could have accused her of doing anything that was not completely seemly and proper. And so, after a moment, he went on with the service. But Igraine's attention, too, had been distracted. She tried to keep her mind on the service. She murmured the proper responses. But she couldn't think about the priest's words, nor of her son who was being married, nor of Guinevere who was, she could sense without seeing, looking around under the cover of her veil for Lancelot at Arthur's side. Now she could think only of her daughter. When the service was over, and the wedding, she would see her, and know where she had gone and what had befallen her. Then, raising her eyes just a moment as the priest's man was reading aloud the story of the wedding in Cana, she looked round at Arthur, and she saw that his eyes, too, were fixed on Morgaine. Chapter 6. Seated among Morgause's ladies, Morgaine listened quietly to the services, her head bent, and her face wearing a polite mask of respect. Inwardly she was all impatience. Such nonsense! As if a house built by the hands of man could be converted by the words of some priest into an abiding place for the spirit which wasn't of man's making at all. Her mind ran unruly. She was weary of Morgause's court. Now she was back in the mainstream of events, and it was as if she'd been cast from a backwater, a stagnant pond water, into the channel of a racing river. She felt alive again. Even at Avalon, quiet and secluded as it was, she had had the sense of being in touch with the flow of life. But among the women of Morgause, she felt she was idle, stagnant, useless. Now she was moving once more, whereas since the birth of her son she had been standing still. She thought for a moment of her little son, Gwydion. He hardly knew her now. When she would have picked him up and petted him, he fought and struggled to go to his foster mother. Even now the memory of his small arms winding about her neck made her weak and regretful, but she forced the memory away. He didn't even know he was her son. He would grow up to think himself one of Morgause's brood. Morgaine was content to have it so, but she couldn't stifle her reluctant sorrow. Well, she supposed that all women felt such regret when they must leave their child. But all women must endure it, except for homekeeping women who were content to do for their babes what any foster mother or servant girl could do, and have no greater work measured to their hands. Even a cowherd must leave her babes to tend her flocks. How much more so a queen or a priestess? Even Vivian had given up her children, as had Igraine. Arthur looked manly and handsome. He had grown, his shoulders broadened. He was no longer the slender boy who had come to her with the deer's blood on his face. There had been power. Not these tame mouthings of the doings of their god, who had meddled about turning water into wine, which would be blasphemy anyway to the gifts of the goddess. Or did the tale mean that to the joining of man and woman in wedlock, the ferment of the spirit would transform their coupling into a sacred thing, as in the great marriage? For Arthur's sake she hoped it would be so with this woman, whoever she was. She could see, from where she knelt behind Morgause, only a cloud of pale golden hair, crowned with the paler gold of a bridal coronet, and a white robe of some fine and precious fabric. Arthur raised his eyes to look on his bride, and his gaze fell on Morgaine. She saw his face change, and thought, with a stir of awareness, "So, he recognized me. I cannot have changed so much as he has changed. He has grown from boy to man, and I was already a woman, and it hasn't changed me as much as that." She hoped that Arthur's bride would love him, and that he would love her well. In her mind rang Arthur's desolate words, "For all my life I will always remember you, and love you, and bless you. But it mustn't be so. He must forget. He must come to see the goddess only in his chosen wife." There stood Lancelot beside him. How could the years have changed and sobered Arthur so much, and left Lancelot untouched and unchanged? No, he had changed too. He looked sad. There was a long scar on his face which ran up into his hair and left a small white streak in it. Kai was thinner and more stooped, his limp more pronounced. He looked on Arthur as a devoted hound looks at his master. Half hoping Half fearing, Morgaine looked about to see if Vivian had come to see Arthur wedded as she had seen him crowned. But the Lady of the Lake wasn't here. There was the Merlin, his grey head bent in what almost looked like prayer, and behind him, standing, a tall shadow with too much of sense to bend the knee to this stupid mummery, was Kevin the Bard. Good for him. The mass concluded. The bishop, a tall, ascetic-looking man with a sour face, was pronouncing the words of dismissal. Even Morgaine bent her head. Vivian had taught her to show at least outward respect to the manifestations of another's faith, since, as she said, all faith was of the gods. The only head unbent in the church was that of Kevin, standing proudly erect. Morgaine wished she had the courage to get up and stand beside him, head unbowed. Why was Arthur so reverential? Had he not sworn a solemn oath to regard Avalon as well as the priests? Must a day come when she or Kevin must remind Arthur of the vow? Surely that white, pious church angel he was marrying would do nothing to help. They should have married Arthur to a woman of Avalon. It wouldn't be the first time a sworn priestess had been joined to a king. The idea shook her, and she stifled her unease with a quick picture of Raven as High Queen. At least she would have the Christian virtue of silence. Morgaine bent her head and bit her lip, suddenly afraid she would giggle aloud. The mass came to an end. The people began to stream toward the doorway. Arthur and his companions stayed where they were, and at a gesture from Kai, Lot and Morgawes approached him, Morgaine moving along behind them. She saw that Igraine and the Merlin and the silent Harper remained as well. She raised her eyes and met her mother's glance. She knew, with something as poignant as the sight, that except for the presence of the bishop, she would even now be clasped in Igraine's arms. She flushed a little, turning away from Igraine's eager eyes. She had thought as little as she could of Igraine, conscious only that in her presence she must guard the one thing Igraine must never know, who had fathered her child. Once, in that long, desperate struggle which she could hardly remember, she thought she had cried aloud, like a child, for her mother. But she'd never been sure. Even now she feared any contact with the mother who had once had the sight, who knew the ways of Avalon. Morgaine might manage to put aside all her childhood training and guilt, but would Igraine chide her for what had not, after all, been her own choice? Lot now came to bend the knee before Arthur, and Arthur, his young face serious and kindly, raised Lot and kissed him on both cheeks. "I'm glad you could come to my wedding, Uncle. I'm glad I have so faithful a friend and kinsman to guard my northern shores. And your son Gawain is my dear friend and closest companion. And you, Aunt, I owe you a debt of thanks for giving me your son for so loyal a companion." Morgawes smiled. She was, Morgaine thought, still beautiful. Far more so than Igraine. "Well, sire, you will have cause to thank me again soon enough, for I have younger sons who talk of nothing but the time when they may come to serve the High King." "They will be as welcome as their elder brother," Arthur said courteously, and looked past Morgawes to where Morgaine knelt. "Welcome, sister. At my crowning I made you a promise which now I shall redeem. Come." He stretched out his hand to her. Morgaine rose, feeling the clasp of his hand and the tension in it. He didn't meet her eyes, but led her past the others to where the white-clad woman knelt in the cloud of her golden hair. "My lady," he said softly. And for a moment, Morgaine wasn't sure to which of them he was speaking. He looked from one to the other, and as Guinevere rose and looked up, her eyes met Morgaine's in a moment of shocked recognition. "Guinevere, this is my sister, Morgaine, Duchess of Cornwall.
It is my wish that she should be first among your ladies-in-waiting, as she is highest in rank here among them.
Morgaine saw Guinevere moisten her lips with her small pink tongue like a kitten's.
My lord and king, the Lady Morgaine and I have met.
What? Where? Arthur demanded, smiling. Morgaine said just as stiffly,
It was while she was at school in a nunnery on Glastonbury, my lord. She lost her way in the mists and blundered on to the shores of Avalon.
As on that faraway day, it seemed suddenly as if something grey and dismal, like ash, had covered and choked the fine day. Morgaine felt, in spite of her fine, decent gown and beautifully woven veil, as if she were some gross, dwarfish, earthly creature before the ethereal whiteness and precious gold of Guinevere. It lasted only a moment. Then Guinevere stepped forward and embraced her, kissing her on the cheek, as was seemly for a kinswoman.
Morgaine, returning the embrace, felt that Guinevere was fragile as precious glass, unlike her own gnarled wood solidness, felt herself shrinking back, shy and stiff, so that she might not feel Guinevere shrink from her. Her lips felt coarse against the rose-leaf softness of the other girl's cheek.
Guinevere said softly,
I shall welcome the sister of my lord and husband, my lady of Cornwall. May I call you Morgaine, sister?
Morgaine drew a long breath and muttered, As it pleases you, my lady. When she had said it, she knew that she sounded ungracious, but she didn't know what she should have said instead. Standing next to Arthur, she looked up to see Gawain regarding her with a faint frown. Lot was a Christian only because it was expedient, but Gawain was genuinely devout in his blunt way. His disapproving glance stiffened Morgaine's back. She had as good a right to be here as Gawain himself. It would be amusing to see some of these stiff-necked companions of Arthur lose their proper manners around a Beltane fire.
Well, Arthur had sworn to honour the people of Avalon as well as the Christians that might yet come about here at Arthur's court. Perhaps that was why she herself was here.
Guinevere said, I hope we shall be friends, lady. I remember that you and the Lord Lancelot set me on my way when I was lost in those dreadful mists. Even now I shudder at the memory of that terrible place, she said, and raised her eyes to Lancelot where he stood behind Arthur.
Morgaine, attuned to the mood around them, followed her eyes and wondered why Guinevere spoke to him now, then realized that the other woman couldn't help it. She was bound as if on a string by Lancelot's eyes.
And Lancelot was looking at Guinevere as a hungry dog looks at a dripping bone. If Morgaine had to meet this pink and white precious creature again in Lancelot's presence, it was well for them both that it was just as Guinevere was about to be married to someone else. She sensed Arthur's hand still in hers, and that troubled her too. That bond, too, would be broken when he had taken Guinevere to bed.
Guinevere would become the goddess to Arthur, and he wouldn't look at Morgaine any more in that way that troubled her so. She was Arthur's sister, not his lover. She was the mother not of his son, but the son of the Horned One, and so it must be.
But I have not broken that bond either.
True, I was ill after my son was born, and I had no will to fall like a ripe apple into Lot's bed, so I played Lady Chastity herself wherever Lot could see me.
But she looked at Lancelot, hoping to intercept the glance between his eyes and Guinevere's. He smiled, but he looked past her.
Guinevere took Morgaine's hand in one of hers, reached to Igraine with the other.
"Soon you will be as my own sister and my own mother," she said, "for I have neither mother nor sister living. Come and stand beside me as we are joined in marriage, mother and sister."
Stiffen her heart as she might against Guinevere's charm,
Morgaine was warmed by those spontaneous words, and she returned the pressure of the girl's warm little fingers. Igraine reached past Guinevere to touch Morgaine's hand, and Morgaine said, "I have not had time to greet you properly, my mother," and let go of Guinevere's hand for a moment to kiss Igraine. She thought, as for a moment the three of them stood in a brief embrace, all women indeed are sisters under the goddess.
"Well, come then," said the Merlin pleasantly. "Let us have the marriage signed and witnessed, and then for feasting and revelry."
Morgaine thought the bishop looked sober, but he too said amiably enough,
"Now that our spirits are all lifted up and in charity, indeed, let us make merry as is suitable for Christian folk on such a day of good omen."
Standing beside Guinevere at the ceremony, Morgaine sensed that the girl was trembling. Her mind went back to the day of the deer hunting. At least she herself had been stimulated and exalted by ritual, but even so, she had been frightened. She had clung to the old priestess. Suddenly, with an impulse of kindness, she wished she could give to Guinevere, who after all had been convent-reared and had none of the old wisdom, some of the instruction given to the younger priestesses. Then she would know how to let the life currents of sun and summer and earth and life flood through her. She could truly become the goddess to Arthur and he the god to her, so that their marriage wouldn't be an empty form, but a true inner binding on all the levels of life. She almost found herself searching for the words, then remembered that Guinevere was a Christian and wouldn't thank Morgaine for such teaching. She sighed, frustrated, knowing she wouldn't speak. She raised her eyes and met Lancelot's, and for a moment he held her glance. She found herself remembering that sun-flooded moment on the tour, when they should have been bound as man and woman, goddess to god. She knew he was remembering too. But he dropped his eyes and looked away, signing himself, as the priest had done, with the cross. The simple ceremony was over. Morgaine affixed her name as witness to the marriage contract, noting how smooth and flowing her own hand was next to Arthur's sprawling signature. Guinevere's clumsy and childish letters. Had the nuns of Glastonbury so little learning? Lancelot signed too, and Gawain, and King Bors of Brittany, who had come as witness, and Lot, and Ectorius, and King Pellinore, whose sister had been Guinevere's mother. Pellinore had a young daughter with him, whom he solemnly beckoned forward.
"My daughter Elaine, your cousin, my lady and queen, I beg you to accept her service."
"I shall be happy for her company among my ladies," Guinevere said, smiling.
Morgaine thought that Pellinore's daughter was very like Guinevere, pink and golden, though a little dimmer than Guinevere's bright radiance, and wearing simple linen dyed with saffron, which dulled the coppery gold of her hair.
"What is your name, cousin? How old are you?"
"Elaine, my lady, and I'm 13 years old."
She dropped a deep curtsy, so deep that she stumbled, and Lancelot caught her. She blushed deeply and hid her face behind her veil. Lancelot smiled indulgently, and Morgaine felt a sickening pang of jealousy. He wouldn't look at her. He would look only at these pale gold-white angels. No doubt he too thought her little and ugly. And at that moment all her kindness for Guinevere faded into anger, and she had to turn her face away. Guinevere had to spend the next hours welcoming, it seemed, every king in the whole of Britain, and being presented to their wives, sisters, and daughters. When it came time to sit at the feast, in addition to Morgaine and Elaine and Igraine and Morgause, she had to show courtesy and graciousness to Flavilla, Arthur's foster mother, and mother of Sir Kai, to the Queen of North Wales, who had her own name, Guinevere, but was dark and Roman-looking, and to half a dozen others. She whispered to Morgaine.
I don't know how I'm ever to remember all their names. Shall I simply call them all my lady and hope they don't